Hello and welcome to the Week 7 edition of Flight Deck, an inside look at the New York Jets. I'm your host, Rich Cimini, Jets reporter for ESPN. Thanks for joining us again this week. It is a special show on tap. We're going to take a break from the gloom and doom of this 0-6 season, which includes another brutal loss, this one to Miami. Going to take a break from that and devote our second and third quarters to a much happier time in Jets history. This week is the 20th anniversary of the Midnight Miracle, the iconic comeback over the Dolphins in 2000. Who could ever forget that night at the Meadowlands? And in the second quarter, our guest is going to be Wayne Krabet, the legendary receiver for the Jets, a Ring of Honor member, and played such a huge role in that game. And then, back-to-back interviews in the third quarter, we have none other than Jumbo Elliott, the 320-pound lineman who made that improbable TD catch that is part of NFL lore. So please stay tuned for that. It's a lot of fun. For now, we're going to take care of some business and deal with the Jets. Of course, another absolutely, really a no-show performance against Miami. The top storyline with the team, though, right now is, look, the fans are sick of what's going on. You guys are already looking forward to next year, and I don't blame you. And right now, the Jets are the only winless team, so they have the front-runner position for the number one pick. According to our analytics people, the Jets have a 57% chance of getting the first pick in the 21 draft. And of course, the big prize is Trevor Lawrence, the quarterback from Clemson, who is, let's face it, he's going to be part of the narrative for the rest of the Jets season. You know, and part of me feels bad for Sam Darnold because it seems like only yesterday that we were welcoming him to New York as the so-called savior. I like Sam. I still think he has untapped potential, but we have to deal with reality here. And the reality is this. If the Jets get the number one pick, Joe Douglas is going to take Trevor Lawrence. I mean, it's not like he doesn't like Sam. In fact, as we talked about in a recent show, he actually had Sam as his number one rated quarterback in the 2018 draft, ahead of players like Josh Allen, Baker Mayfield, and Lamar Jackson. So we know he likes Sam, but Trevor Lawrence is on a different level prospect. You talk to scouts, and I've talked to them. They say he's the guy who comes along at once every 10 years, the complete package of physical, mental makeup. He's being compared to the likes of Andrew Luck, Peyton Manning, John Elway. In 35 games at Clemson, His TD interception ratio is just like something from a Madden video game. It's 81 touchdowns, 13 interceptions. This year, he's completing 73% of his passes with 15 touchdowns and one interception. It's just more than numbers, though. I mean, it's just the size, the arm strength, the poise. He's got everything. And Sam Darnold is, you know, he's been an inconsistent quarterback throughout his career. You know, you see the arm talent. You love his ability to improvise outside the pocket, but he hasn't put it all together yet. He really hasn't had a stretch where you could say three or four really good games in a row. Do I think he'd be better with better coaching and a better supporting cast? No question. I think he still has the ability to be a longtime starter in this league, but the Jets can't pass on the golden ticket. I mean, you know, it's just, and it comes down to money. I always tell people, follow the money. Especially in a situation like this. Let's look at it. Sam Darnold is going to make $4.6 million next year guaranteed. His fifth-year option for 2022 is going to be about $25 million. Now, at this point, there's no way the Jets are going to pick up that option. But let's say he plays well the second half of the year, and they do. Then you're talking about $29.6 million over 2 years. And then he's a free agent. Now, with Trevor Lawrence, it's a different story. You draft him, you're restarting the clock on your quarterback contract. Just as an example, Joe Burrow, the number one pick in this year's draft for Cincinnati, four-year contract for $36 million. You know, that's a slotted figure, and I think it'll be about the same next year because I don't think the cap is going to go up. It may actually go down a little bit. So you get Trevor Lawrence for $36 million over 4 years, and then possibly Sam Darnold for close to $30 million over two. It's simple economics. You have 4 years of fixed cost with Lawrence, only 2 years for Darnold, and that's on the kind of the leap of faith and an assumption that they would pick up that fifth-year option. Right now, they wouldn't. So that's the facts. I mean, those are the numbers. That's the money figure. And Joe Douglas is not going to be able to, ignore that. It's a huge dynamic in that decision. What the Jets have to do now is get Sam Darnold healthy. I think there's a chance he could play this week against Buffalo. Get him healthy. Let him play the second half of the year. Maybe you boost his trade value. If he plays well and the Jets win some games and they don't get the number one pick, well, then you feel better about Darnold, and then you have to make a decision on Darnold versus, say, Justin Fields of Ohio State or Darnold versus Trey Lance of North Dakota State. That becomes a much more complicated decision for Joe Douglas because Fields and Lance, while they're considered top five kind of prospects, they're not on the level of a Trevor Lawrence. So that's – look – I hate to be doing this, but that's going to be the narrative over the second half of the season. As we've seen, the Jets are already in fire sale mode after cutting Le'Veon Bell. And then after the game on Sunday, they trade Steve McClendon to Tampa, a move that no one likes from an emotional standpoint because everybody likes Steve McClendon, but a move that just makes sense from a football standpoint. The Jets have to get younger and let guys like Foley Fadakasi get more playing time. So who's next? Well, I mean, Frank Gore would certainly be a guy you would say they could move on from, but we know Adam Gase just loves the guy, and really he's the only running back they could rely on, so I'm not so sure they would move on from him, even though they need to start playing LaMichael Pirine. You know, Quincy Wilson was just a bad trade for the Jets. I could see him going at any time. Henry Anderson, I would say he's on thin ice. He hasn't done much for the last year and a half, but he is owed $4 million guaranteed unless the Jets want to eat that money, a la Le'Veon Bell. They'd probably keep Anderson, but there's nothing he's done on the field that is keeping him around. And then later in the year, I mean, maybe you move on from Joe Flacco. I mean, realistically, if Darnold's healthy, maybe they should just promote James Morgan, the rookie, to the backup role, let him get more practice reps and see what you have. Flacco, we've seen what he is. We know what he is. What's the point, really, once we get later in the season? You might as well let the young kids play a chance. It's the worst-case scenario for the Jets. I mean, they've only played six games. They're 0-6, and they're in fire sale mode.
Okay, we're going to take a break from the bleak season that is ongoing right now and look back at one of the great games in New York Jets history, the 20-year anniversary of the Midnight Miracle, October 25th, 2000, Jets 40, Dolphins 37 in overtime, a game that ended at 1:15, and we are so privileged to have one of the stars of that game with us. Thank you so much, Wayne Corbett, for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Yeah, can you believe it's been 20 years since that game?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like it's been, you know, longer than that, but sometimes it feels like yesterday. Just, you know, the amount of content they show on the TV and the radio, listening and seeing the game again, it's like just one of those special nights.
That truly is. I mean, other than Super Bowl III, which was long before our time, but the Midnight Miracle might be one of the greatest ever. Was that the most memorable game you've ever played in?
Yeah, you know, other than some of the, you know, playoff games. But, yeah, with the NFL Network and everything like that, they play it all the time, and all the time people post on my social media links, you know, the plays from that night. So, you know, kind of fresh in my memory. I haven't seen it in the last couple of weeks.
Man, and so, you know, people forget the Jets. That was a really big game for the Jets. You guys went into that game. You were 5-1 against an arch rival in the Miami Dolphins, and you guys were playing really good football. And all of a sudden, you know, it was like nothing in the first half. You guys were down 23-7 at halftime. Like, what's going through your mind?
You know what? It felt worse than 23-7. I know I scored at the end of the half, which at that point didn't think it meant much. But, you know, we went from not being able to do anything right to not being able to do anything wrong. So once we started coming back, I don't know, I think we all had the same opinion that, you know, we're so much better than what we're doing. And, you know, that it's not too late. We still had a half to go, but, you know, we still came out slow in the second half. But as everybody saw, you know, quickly the momentum changed in our way.
Yeah, and this was a Monday night game, so the entire country is watching this, and, yeah, you know, which was probably not a great thing in the first half. So you go into halftime, We're down 23-7. I'm wondering what's the mood in there at halftime? What are people doing? What are people saying?
You know, it's the kind of thing where we had great veteran leadership. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, those are the guys that kind of get everybody into the, you know, into the corner or this part of the locker room, just to, you know, kind of like give each other a gut check. Like, listen, this isn't us. We're better than this. And just to say, you know, everybody's watching. We're the only game in town, Monday Night Football. You know, we can't embarrass ourselves like this. And then we turned it around.
It took a little while, though, because in the third quarter was a little bit more of the same. So it's actually 30-7 at the end of the third quarter. So you guys are down 23 points going into the fourth quarter. There probably isn't a soul in that stadium. People are leaving. You know, the parking lot's filling up with cars. And do you remember Lavernia scored to get things going? What do you recall what the spark was to get things turned around?
Probably that. I mean, yeah. And that was his first career touchdown. And yeah. if you watch it, I mean, you know, Sam Madison, he was probably all-pro corner at that time. You know, he just took it away from him. And that kind of like, we got a little something. We got a little something going, and then you get the ball back, and then it's like, all right, we got some time, but not a lot of time. And then, you know, just all of a sudden, everything started going our way.
And then Jermaine Wiggins scores, and I believe that was his first NFL touchdown. Yeah. And then you tie it with the touch, you know, like it was a great catch. What do you remember about that game-tying touchdown? You made it 30-30.
If you ever watched a play from the end zone where you're watching me, I was actually looking for him to throw it inside. And he threw it outside. It was like a post corner. He threw it to the corner. And I kind of like tracked it. And then just the last second was able to lunge it and get it. But, at that point when we tied it up, it was like, this is great. You know, nothing can stop us now. And obviously they scored right after I scored. But, you know, at that point, we felt we had a good chance to win.
That was just such an unbelievable catch you made. I mean, you had so many great catches in your career. Where does that rank up there in terms of, you know, the difficulty factor and the importance in the game?
Yeah, definitely one of the most, you know, opportune catch, just how important was it at time to tie it up. But, I mean, he put it. All I ever tell Vinny and the guys is put it somewhere where I can get to it. You know, nobody else can. If I can't catch it, I won't let him intercept it. But just put it somewhere so they can't get to it. And you know, Vinny had a lot of confidence in me and Lavernius, and he just gave us a chance to make plays all night.
So Wayne, take me inside the huddle when you guys are rolling now. You have the momentum going. The game's tied. Can you just? Inside the huddle, do guys feel that vibe? Are you like all of a sudden there's an energy?
Yeah, it's fun. You know, you know when you're losing, you're in the huddle. It's just like you're listening, and, you know, but then when you're coming back and stuff, and there's the energy in there, you kind of like we're all facing each other, so you're looking at each other in the eyes, and the smiles are there, and the excitement's there, and it's completely different from the first half, and then you just. You know, you're thirsty to win the game. It's different once you get that little momentum going.
So one of the great subplots that comes out of this game, and you know this very well, is that Arnold Schwarzenegger goes up in the booth for the Monday night at the end of the third quarter, and they ask him about the game. And at this point, you guys are down 30-7 at the end of the third quarter. And, you know, Arnold, in his accent, I'm not even going to try to impersonate him. I'll embarrass myself. But, you know, he says, you know, the Jets are going to come back and win this game, and Wayne Krabbet will pull it off.
And hey, Wayne Krabbet will pull it off. I was like, close enough. I was like, I know who he meant, but
he mispronounced your name a little bit. But And then he goes, I think the Dolphins will have to be terminated. And people are thinking, this guy is absolutely crazy. When did you find out about the Arnold thing, what he said during the game?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen it a lot, but Krabbet, he says. But I'm just fascinated that he knew my name, which is pretty cool. But it's just part of that night. You know, it's like a Hollywood script anyway. The fact, you know, how we came back like that. So you know, to have him say that, you know, kind of fits in. You know.
And the funny thing is, I think he left the stadium right after that interview, so he wasn't even around for the great comeback in the fourth.
Right.
I think he was at some party in New York City or something, but
okay.
It's the Miami goes up 37-30, and though so then the jumbo play happens. you know, everyone knows tackle eligible. Vinny tosses the ball in the end zone, you know, with a minute 20 to go. Jumbo kind of makes this falling down catch, this 300-pound tackle, holds on to the ball. When that play comes in the huddle and you hear the call there, it's a second and goal from the three. Are you thinking, like, we're going to throw the ball to Jumbo? What's going through your mind?
I don't think – I think it went okay in practice when we practiced it. I can't remember how it was all week, but, you know, he had those big hamburger, you know, lineman gloves on. But, you know, I always say it's like the best three catches anybody ever said. He caught it three times. I mean, and just his face, his expression on the Jumbotron was awesome. But I don't know. You know, just as far as great calls at a time, like this, you know, just like Curtis's halfback pass.
Right.
Why would you put the ball in the hands of a halfback in such an important, you know, part of a game? But, you know, he came through. You know, you practice a play like that all year for that specific opportunity.
Yeah.
And it works for us. I'm not saying Curtis could have ran it in, but it just made it that much sweeter, you know?
Right. And of course, Jet fans know you're referring to that tremendous play against Tampa Bay where Curtis threw in the rain through a wobbler, and you caught it in the back of the end zone for the game-winning touchdown. Truly one of the more memorable plays in history. And so Jumbo ties it, you know, 37 all, which was a priceless moment. And you're right, I think he did catch it about three or four times. They had the instant replay review confirm the catch. And then the Jets go on to win it in overtime on a John Hall field goal at about 1:15 in the morning. Take me inside the locker room after the game. I mean, what you guys pull off like an absolute miracle.
No, it's exciting. We're spent. I mean, I don't know how many plays we ran in the fourth quarter. I mean, we had like 20 first downs, something crazy like that. But it was that we're elated. We're excited. Like you said, that was an important game. But it was just this, you know, last third of that game was just exciting. I mean, it was fun. It's why you started playing football as a kid. So, no, we were at cloud nine after the game.
Vinny Testaverde, man, in that game, especially in the fourth quarter, he threw for 378 total and five touchdowns. Describe Vinny in that game.
Hey, he never wavered. You know, he was always confident in there, just, you know, encouraging, like, listen, we'll get it. Don't worry about it. And then he just got on fire. And, you know, I always say if Vinny hadn't played in Tampa in the beginning of his career, he would be a Hall of Fame player. I mean, I think he had that kind of ability, that kind of leadership. So, you know, I loved playing with him.
And one of the guys who I don't think gets enough credit for what he did in that game, Richie Anderson, he caught 12 passes in that game, which is, you know, talk about Richie, man. What a player he was.
Definitely underappreciated, but he had great hands for a running back. But I remember the fourth down play that he caught and just got absolutely killed on. Mm-hmm. He was a great player. Like I said, definitely underappreciated. You never hear his name, you know, when people are talking about Jets football, but definitely has a place as one of the, you know, the greater players that played for the organization.
And this guy, Wayne Corbett, was pretty good in that game, too. You had six catches for 104 and a couple of touchdowns. And I'm just curious, now that it's been 20 years removed, when you're out in public, when you're doing a signing show or something like that, I mean, how often does this game get mentioned when you're mingling with Jet fans?
You know what? I think fans take it as a source of pride. Like, you know, while we talk to people like, oh, and I never left the Monday Night Miracle. I stayed the whole night. It's like a badge of honor that, you know, I didn't give up on the team. This is what kind of fan I am. So it's kind of like it's just funny how people feel that if they tell me they stayed the whole game, it tells me what kind of fan they are. So I hear it all the time.
Yeah. Although a lot of fans did leave. I think fans were leaving and then tried to come back in that game. That's the way legend has it. I mean, I've been covering the Jets for 31 years. I mean, that is probably the most amazing game that I've covered. I mean, it was very hectic to write that story on deadline because everything kept changing. But is there one snapshot moment that when you think back to that game 20 years later, is there one moment that just kind of sticks with you?
You know, it kind of relates to what you're saying. With people coming back in, The lower bowl was completely full. Up top wasn't. It was as loud as I've heard it, you know, in a game for that amount of fans there. And when I caught the pass, you could see, was it Dennis Miller? Was he the announcer?
Yeah, he was the color guy.
Yeah, he said, Krebet is magic. And as I score, you see John Lally pumping his fist, and you see, like, the fans in the lower bowl going absolutely crazy. And when I see that, then I remember how great it was, like, in sync we were with the fans, how, like, we were feeding off of them, and they were feeding off of us. It was just seeing the fan reaction to my touchdown was pretty special. That's what I remember about it.
Yeah, that's really well said. I mean, it was just a different time. As we know, the Jets are going through some struggles now, but that game in 2000 was just incredible.
Yeah.
How many times do you get asked to, like, autograph? Do people, like, hand you pictures of that game, or you know, like, any? Do you have any memorabilia from that game? First of all,
not sure.
See that Hofstra helmet?
I had the touchdown balls.
Oh, do you?
I pretty much have all my touchdown balls, but yeah. I mean, just one of those nights, man. You don't need any kind of memento. It just, you know, kind of sticks in your mind a little bit.
Absolutely. I just want to ask you about, I know you're a super Jet fan now and you bleed green, and just what's it like for you just to see them struggling now and going through some of the things they're going through?
It's tough. It's tough to watch. You know, I felt that they had a good draft. I liked their draft. I felt that they didn't do a lot in the offseason, the free agency, but I felt the guys they got were great contributors, the solid players, not flashy names, but good locker room guys too, good guys in that way, but a good leadership, but guys were injured, guys opted out, guys got traded. It's like the perfect storm. And I've had years where nothing bounced our way. We fumble, goes right in our hands. They fumble, goes out of bounds, or they recover. It's just nothing works out for you. You know, in a 1-15 season I was in. And it's tough. It's tough at this point to know you're just about midway through the season. You're pretty much going to be, like, you know, out of the playoff contention, you know, halfway through the year. That's tough to come into work every day. But they're going to have to find a way to try to get some wins, or, you know, it's just going to be one of the worst seasons they've had. But I'm hoping they could turn it around a little bit.
You mentioned the 96 team. Of course, you guys go 1-15, and you started out 0-8. What was it like to – so you know what these guys are going through now. You lived that in your second year in the league. What was that like going through 96 week after week, you know, just the losing? What are your memories of that season?
It's tough. It's really tough. Like you said, you know, you're 0-8, and you're like, wow. Well, I trained all year for this, and we're not even going to make the play. We have 8 games to go, and pretty much mathematically we're almost eliminated. But at that point, you're concerned about your job, knowing if the team doesn't have a good year, they're going to be looking to get rid of everybody. So you just can focus on that. You can focus on, you know, being there for your teammates and the fans. But it's tough, man. I don't wish that upon anybody.
I was talking to Neil O'Donnell one time, and he was reminiscing about – because that season – He tore his calf muscle as he was warming up in the end zone before one of the games. He slipped on the paint in the end zone, and he said, you were standing by him, and you said, like, what's wrong, Neil? And he goes, I think I blew out my leg, you know, like my calf or my Achilles or something. And he said, you reacted like, what? You got to be kidding. Do you remember, like, warming up with him in the end zone?
No, I don't remember. I'm sure that's something I would have said, but I know it happened. I don't know if I was there for it, maybe, but it's just how it is. Yeah. If something could go wrong, it would go wrong. And that's how those first two of my seasons were there. We were 3 wins and 1 win. So, I mean, 4 wins in 2 years. That was a tough way to start.
Well, the good news was 2 years later, you guys got to the playoffs in the AFC Championship games. So there were actually a lot of good players on that 96 team that became the core of the 98 team. So there was talent on that team.
Yeah. Just didn't have the quite right combination of players and coaches that were kind of like aligned. But, you know, at that – going into the 98 season, you know, everything was different. And, you know, the results showed from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Wayne, I can't thank you enough for joining us. I mean, great to reminisce about something really positive, one of the great moments in Jet history, that midnight miracle. And one last thing about that game. Have you ever watched it in its entirety, like since it happened? Or how recently have you watched it?
I've seen it a bunch of times because, like I said, it's on the NFL Network. You know, people post it all the time. But to be honest with you, when I'm going to watch it, I basically watch my touchdown at the end of the half, and I watch the second half. I never actually watch the first half because I have no interest in watching us play that bad. So I'll start it off basically, you know, in the second half of the comeback because it's, you know, miserable watching when you're not doing well. But, the second half is as good as Jets football as you'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. Wayne, thank you so much. Best to you and your family, and hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Rich. Take care.
And welcome back. This is the third quarter of Flight Deck, and we have coming up our interview with Jumbo Elliott on the miracle game for the Jets. Little background on Jumbo and I. We actually have known each other since we were kids. We grew up in the same town, went to the same high school, Sachem High School. I'm 2 years older. But we actually knew each other much younger than that. We were in the Boy Scouts together, the same Boy Scout troop, went camping, did stuff like that. Believe it or not, there was a time when I was actually taller than Jumbo, but that changed, I think, after his 10th grade year, and I have the pictures to prove it. But always enjoy catching up, one of my favorites.
All right, you can't talk about the Midnight Miracle without one of the stars of the show who made the great touchdown catch, none other than Jumbo Elliott, a longtime friend of mine. Jumbo, thanks for popping in to talk about it.
Richie, how you doing, brother?
All right. It's great. You know, we've been all this Jet talk is really gloomy this year, so we have to brighten it up and talk about one of the great moments in Jet history. You know, beating the Dolphins in that fashion was just unbelievable. Before we get into your spectacular touchdown catch, let's just talk about game and just the swing of emotions. I mean, you guys were as bad as could be in the first half, and all of a sudden just caught fire. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it got to the point, Rich, actually it got to the point on the sidelines there where I was talking to the linemen and the offensive guys, and you know, I was trying to be the elder kind of guy I was, and I was just like, guys, hang in there, you're on film. I just kept reminding guys, you're on film. Yeah. For right. God's sakes, don't give it up. Yeah. Because the whole league sees that film. It circulates around everywhere. And, you know, the coaching staff, you're going to be graded. So I was actually, things were so bad, I was resorting down to that. Like, you know, look out for yourself, fellas. Come on.
Yeah.
So, the second half, man, oh, man. It was like, you know, Vinny started calling his own stuff. You were talking to my buddy Wayne Corbett. Guys were balling. Guys just started playing out of their minds. You know, our defense, you know, came up with several turnovers. You know, our field goal kicker came through in the clutch.
Yep.
You know, so it was a whole different game. You know, Lavernius Coles and Wayne Corbett, two of the toughest kids I played with, you know, real – gutty kind of performers. And then, you know, Vinny was just, you know, he was outstanding, doing his own thing. And then, you know, finally we got to that play, Rich, you know, oh my God, when we called that play, you know, I was in the huddle there down towards the end zone there. And, you know, I got my fingers, my thumbs, you know, at that point in my career tended to like slide out of joint. And, you know, I had some fingers that had been broke over the years. So I'm all taped up really heavy. And they call that play in the huddle, and we break the huddle. I'm going to the line. I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, this play's coming to me. what the heck? But, we, you know, I didn't have really time to think. You know, I'm down in my stance. Vinny's going through the cadence. And I'm like, son of a gun. All right, think about your release. Like, look at me. I'm a 320-pound guy. And I was like, think about your release. Are you kidding me? So, you know, fortunately, I think Trace Armstrong was lined up across from me, and he didn't have a clue what I was doing. Yeah. And, you know, so there I am, wide open. And Vinny tried to throw the softest. He tried to make it as easy as possible for me. and I tried my best to drop that thing.
About three times.
Yeah, I think I could have been a leading receiver. I caught it so many times. But the, but ended up being one of those, I like to call it very athletic play.
Did you – you must have practiced it during the week, right? I mean, you must have had at least one rep with that.
Yeah, you know, during a year we had a package there where there was like three different plays like that where I'd be out there and Vinny would just whiz it into me in practice. Like, you know, he wouldn't even hold back. You know, Vinny had a great arm strength. Oh. So, you know, it was always fun. And I always, in practice it was like, you know, pretty automatic and – you know, not a fun thing, not a big thing. Didn't think it was going to happen in a game, but our offensive coordinator and I think my coach Billy Muir, my position coach, had a little sway on what play was called at that point. You know, and they they just pulled it out of nowhere because I guess they were saving it.
They saved it for the right time. That was actually there was a second down and goal from the three. So you come into the huddle thinking that what you're going to be like an extra blocker and a running play or something like that, right? So you don't actually find out about that play until you're in the huddle.
Oh, exactly. You know, oh my gosh. The you're exactly right. And like I said, you know, by that that was towards the end of my career. So I had a lot of spine issues and different issues going on, and so you know, but that night, you know, Billy Muir comes up to me in the locker room. He says, "Jumbo, I need you ready." Cause he was worried about, you know, I had, you know, blocked Jason Taylor like a dozen times or so in the past. And he was worried about that night with Jason causing a little havoc. So he's like, "Look, I need you ready to go, big guy, just in case." So I taped up extra heavy, unlike practice. So I taped all those fingers and stuff that have been popping out over the years extra heavy in case I had, you know, I needed to go in and take care of business. And next thing you know, that play's called and I'm down to my stance. I'm thinking, oh my God, how do I get this? Can't get this tape off. How am I going to hold this thing? That's why you saw me bear hug it, right?
Yeah.
At the end, I was like, I just grab it like a hero.
Yeah. But one of the great memorable moments was the look on your face that got onto the Jumbotron, you know, after that catch. I'm sure you probably have a picture of that or something, right?
Oh, that was embarrassing. I had no idea. Yeah, look, I'm not used to that kind of stuff, so I didn't think about home. I wasn't trying to look cool, like thinking I was going to be on TV.
Now, let me ask you this. You had a great career with the New York Giants, and you won a Super Bowl. You played one of the great Super Bowls ever. You played an awesome game against Bruce Smith. I mean, great career. But, you know, you make this touchdown catch for the Jets in a very memorable game. Like when you go out in public and you bump into fans in the New York area, like which comes up more? Like, hey, you know, the Super Bowl win and the Giants, you know, or did you get here from about this, you know, the Midnight Miracle catch?
Yeah, you know, I hear a lot about the Super Bowl, obviously, because Super Bowl is a Super Bowl, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that team. But Jets fans, you know, both fan bases are great. I was very fortunate to play for both New York teams. But the, you know, the Jets fans always remember the miracle in the Meadowlands. And the Giants fans always want to remind me, you're a Giant, Jumbo. It's So I just play the middle.
Yeah, you get the best of both worlds there.
Exactly. You know? Then I try to see who's winning, and I lean that way any particular year now.
Yeah. Not too much leaning. This year is a tough year to lean, right?
Well, let's talk about
this year. So it's getting a lot of comparisons to the 96 Jets because the 96 Jets were 1-15. I don't want to bring up a bad memory, but you were on that team in 96. Do you see the parallels?
I wasn't a Giant still. You sure?
Yeah. You came to the Jets. You came to the Jets for the big money. And what's it like to go through? I mean, what was 96 like for you?
All right, 96 was something. So I come over to the Jets, and I was always used to a certain way of doing things, the organization and the coaching staff and everything. So it was a big change for me. So I came from the Bill Parcells and his staff. You know, even when he left, his staff was mostly there. And then, you know, after him, Dan, you know, we had Coach Reeves come in, and he's like an old school Tom Landry kind of guy. So I came over to the Jets, and I was like, it was a little strange. It wasn't the whole building itself wasn't as organized as I was used to being around. So it was definitely different. I thought Coach Kotite was a great guy and some great people. There was some really good staff members, but as a whole, it didn't have that binding organizational feel to it. And, you know, so 96 was a different – that was an outlier. And then if you remember, Rich, it was a very strange year for me because I ripped my hamstring going into camp. And so I missed camp. And like I missed the camp in the first three games, Rich.
Yeah.
So that's like a season, like, I'm a guy, I like to go through camp and I like my reps. Yeah. And so, so personally, it was a very challenging year. And then, you know what happened with the team? It was, we didn't get a win until I think week nine, eight.
Yeah.
Nine or something.
You guys were 0-8. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We're 0-8. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? I was like, is this really, what was I thinking? And then, but we had Coach Earhart on offense, and we took pride in, I'm not sure where we ended up the year, but we had a top 10 offense like the whole year. And we had some real production. We had some really good talent. Guys like, we had Corbett and Jeff Graham, great hands. And then, out of the blue, we find out we're going to get Coach Parcells to change things around. Yeah. And then I remember all those guys on the 96 team, when those rumors started flying around the locker room, they're all asking me, what are we going to do? What's Coach Parcells going to do? and they got a gazillion questions.
And what did you tell them?
Well, I told them, I said, fellas, I said, a lot of you guys aren't going to be here anymore. Things are going to change big time in this building.
Yeah. Yeah.
Matter of fact, I remember talking. Remember Eric Howard?
Yeah.
The defensive line. So Eric Howard had a big knee injury. So he missed 96, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking of whether he should come back or not. Mm-hmm. And once he heard it was Parcells, he loves Parcells. But he's like, I can't do it.
That's what you call culture change.
Yeah.
That was culture change. What was the craziest thing that happened in 96? I remember the Neil O'Donnell blew out his calf in the pregame warmups that one game.
Oh, yeah. What game was that, Richie?
That was against Houston, I think. It was raining at the Meadowlands, and he slipped on the Jet logo in the end zone, and he blew out his calf muscle.
That was very strange. It was really strange. I remember, and Neil was a good guy, but he had a little bit of a rough time with New York. And, it was very strange. And I remember I was actually over in a facility over at Hofstra, the old facility. I remember seeing Neil and our head trainer in the room. They were looking at, like, MRIs. He had an appointment. I had an appointment for my back right after him. So, they were showing me on the thing. It's like, look at this calf muscle. It's like, all right. So it was very strange. I just think that team had so much talent. It wasn't organized and focused enough. And it had me wondering. Starting to doubt. When you lose like that, Richard, oh my God, the wheels start to fall off.
Yeah.
And, you get to a certain point and it feels like guys start to, it's pro sports. So everybody's for themselves a little bit, but it becomes even more so. You lose any kind of team feeling,
right.
It's like, hooray for me and screw you.
Yeah. Well, the Jets are going through it now. It's tough. It's a tough situation. I don't envy any player in that situation.
No, it's really hard. It's, because the fan base is great, but it just makes everything hard. Going to the stadium is probably, I hate to say this in a pandemic, Richard, But, you know, these guys probably have it a little easier with no fans.
That is absolutely true. Could you imagine?
We used to hear it. It would get ugly.
It would get ugly in a stadium, you know.
Well, maybe, you know, but look, Rich, there's a bright spot here. Look at it this way. You know what we went through in 96. But look, when Parcells comes in and organizes a team, the talent was there, right? So next thing you know, in 2 years, we're in a championship game out in Denver. So, you know, sometimes things look bleak, but in today's NFL, you know, you can make a couple moves here and there the way players move around nowadays. You get a little bit more solid coaching, and the whole thing can turn around. It really can if you get the right pieces.
Well, that leaves something for Jet fans maybe to look forward to. But again, Jumbo, I mean, I didn't really want to be a downer and talk about 96. I wanted to talk about the Midnight Miracle and one of the great – do you have any, like, a memento from that game? Do you still have the ball?
I got a lot of stuff. It's in the attic. I have to go through. But I have some game balls and stuff, and that's certainly one of them. So – I don't know, Rich. What should I do with that thing? I don't even look at these things anymore. It's like I got all this stuff from my career. I don't even look at it.
I think you were underutilized as a receiver. You should have complained about not getting more targets.
You talked to Wayne, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Wayne was a little bit worried. He's like, you know, he used to check with me. He's like, Jumbo, come on now. You're good at tackle. You don't have to come out here with us.
I know. He was worried about you stealing some of his targets. So
taking some of his reps, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, that play is just – I think it really brings a smile to any Jet fan, and they could certainly use some smiles the way things are going now. So, Jumbo, man, it's great catching up with you. It really is. We got to do this more often, and enjoy – hopefully you'll get a little this week as the 20 year, man, 20 years. I just can't believe it. That is just, we're getting old, man.
I'm looking at your hairline, Rich. I know mine's receding.
I know. Hey, I've been covering the Jets for 32 years. It's lucky I still have hair. All right, man. It's been great talking to you, Jumbo.
Hey, Rich, I hope that I see you in person. We get past all this pandemic stuff. And we catch up in person, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're shaking it up a little bit this week. We're going to devote the fourth quarter to our Twitter mailbag. A lot of Jet fans chiming in this week after a brutal, brutal 24-0 loss to Miami. At James Lynch 795. If Gase was brought in to improve the development of Sam Darnold and the Jets' fortunes, and has overseen a decline in both, how could the Jets keep him? Well, a very fair question, and I think about 75% of the fans who chimed in on Twitter were asking the same question. So we'll answer it, James. Millionaires don't like to admit mistakes. And Christopher Johnson came out very forcefully a few weeks ago in Adam Gase's defense, called him a brilliant offensive mind. And I don't think he wants to turn around a few weeks later and say, never mind, I was wrong. So I think he's going to play it out. And I think he genuinely likes Adam, and I think he wants to try to see it succeed. Do I think in the back of his mind he has serious, serious doubts? Of course he does. I mean, he's watching these games. He absolutely has doubts, and he probably knows how this is going to end. The timing is weird. I could see something happening, but it hasn't. I think it's a fair question to wonder why it hasn't. But like I said, millionaires don't like to admit mistakes. Next, from at Brian DeBetta, how involved is Christopher Johnson with the team and Joe Douglas? Do you think it would be they would be open to changing their organizational structure? Christopher is very involved. He's at the facility most days. He watches practice. He goes to every game. You see him on the sideline lining up with them for the national anthem. He has conversations every day with Adam Gase and Joe Douglas. He's apprised of roster moves, what they're thinking, even some game plan stuff on a daily basis, you know, so he knows exactly what's going on. He's not making personnel decisions a la Jerry Jones, but he's in on everything. And would they change the structure? As we know right now, the structure is that the head coach and the GM are on the same level and they both report to ownership. I've said it many times in the past. I'm not a huge fan of that. And unless you have a really, really strong and experienced owner, I don't like that structure. And so I do think they would have to be open to changing it because, look, everything has to be on the table. When you're this bad, you have to consider everything. Next, at Dan Bow 76, when was the last time the Jets did a complete teardown and started over as it appears Joe Douglas is doing now? How quickly we forget. This happened in 2017. After that bad year in 2016, when the Jets realized that the team they had from 2015 just got old really fast, they tried to milk a year out of it, and it was a disaster in 16, so they tore it all down in 17. Remember, we had the whole suck for Sam mantra for the entire year. Things got so bad, Woody Johnson was just telling his football people to just get rid of guys, and he told them to get rid of David Harris in March, and they actually procrastinated on it, thinking that he might forget about it. And then 3 months later in June, he's like, how come David Harris is still on the roster? Let's get rid of him. Let's get rid of his $7 million salary. And so that's why in the middle of a mini camp in June, the Jets abruptly released David Harris. And then Woody goes off to England to be the U.S. ambassador, and he left the mess basically in the hands of his younger brother, Christopher. So yes, the Jets have done this before. Next, from at MacQ85, are there any internal candidates to replace Gase? I don't think on a permanent basis, but in terms of the interim, everyone's been speculating about Greg Williams because he's done this before. He did it with Cleveland as the interim and actually did pretty well. But in light of the recent events, his comments about the offense, I don't think the Jets can make Greg Williams the interim. I just think it would send a mixed message. I think Frank Bush is a guy who would probably be the most agreeable, and he's the assistant head coach slash defense linebackers coach, a guy who's been around the league for a long time, very well respected. I could see Frank Bush becoming the interim. And lastly, at Terrence Begley NJ, as in New Jersey, what other quote assets could be dealt? To me, maybe Avery Williamson and maybe Breshad Perryman as a one-year rental for a team looking for a deep threat. Yeah, the Steve McClendon trade, I don't even know if you'd call him an asset. I think they just found the ideal situation in Tampa. They had lost their starting nose tackle, and Todd Bowles is there. He knows Steve really well, so it was kind of a perfect fit situation. I do think Avery Williamson could be attractive to teams, and I think the Jets would be interested in moving him now that Blake Cashman is healthy. And they'd like for someone to pick up Avery's salary. He's in the last year of his contract. Perryman is interesting. Obviously, only on a one-year deal. But if you remove him from the offense, then you're hurting your quarterback. And soon that will be Sam Darnold again. And I think that may be a little counterproductive. They got to do everything they can to try to maximize Darnold's ability to perform over the second half of the season. They do have Denzel Mims coming back, I think, this week. He could be that deep threat, but he's not a proven deep threat. And I don't know if you want to do that to Sam, so I'd be surprised if they move on from Perryman. Well, we're moving on. Thanks for checking in this week on Flight Deck. I had a blast with this show. Thanks to my guests, Wayne Krebet and Jumbo Elliott. Thanks to producer Jeff Scopin for putting this all together. Please rate and subscribe us. Check us out on Apple, Google Play, and Spotify, and of course on all the ESPN platforms. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you next week on Flight Deck.